Well, it is a pleasure to be here again. I think this is the fourth time I've spoken on one of these, and I always learn, which is a large part of the activity. I appreciate Jim organizing it. It was good to hear Doug Burleson yesterday do a masterful job on a fundamental subject. Part of my understanding is that part of this conference is designed to surface issues on which we agree, because we agree on a lot, and also to discuss in a frank and brotherly manner things that we might not see eye to eye on, both in terms of the substance, but then also how do we get to our conclusions. Sometimes it's been my experience, I wind up agreeing with a brother, but I'm shaking my head wondering, how in the world did you get there from the direction you started? So I think it's valuable for us to be here in that regard. And I appreciated Jacob last night reflecting a little bit. I don't think you were here last year, but I did something similar to that. My grandfather and my dad left the Christian church in Indianapolis in the 1930s over some of the same issues in that division between the disciples and the independent Christian churches. That dealt with entertainment and some of the things we're going to unpack this morning. And then later at the Irvington Church, when Earl West left there, Earl was the preacher there, performed the wedding ceremony for my parents when my dad came back from World War II. I've reflected often both what might have happened had Earl stayed there, and my dad not been told by a new preacher and some newer elders, either he was the treasurer and a deacon there, either write a check to a certain orphanage, or if you can't do that, then you can turn in the checkbook and go elsewhere if you can't get with the program, which doesn't leave a 32-year-old guy much room to maneuver with that kind of an ultimatum. But we all come out of this same, many of us anyway, from this same shared historical incubator that hatched us. And we have, in many ways, common roots, and we have, beyond that and deeper than that, bonds in the Lord. And so I'm appreciative of the opportunity to be here. And I'm going to start with something that I referenced actually yesterday that arose, it was in Doug's outline. This is by, in no way disagreeing with him, but it speaks to the question of how we interact with each other and how fair we can be to accurately reflect what another brother is saying. The particular item is William Webb Freeman, who is, I've written a little bit about. Webb Freeman had a sort of spectacular resume, baptized by Joe Warlick. His dad was a preacher. He goes to Potter Bible College back before it became an orphanage when the Harding institutions moved west, wound up at Cordell, but comes back to Louisville, where he does a bachelor's degree at the University of Louisville, which we will not hold against him. You all know what a cardinal is. A cardinal is a small bird that in the springtime sits on the bench and watches the cats play. Well, so we won't hold it against him, but he earns a master's and then later a doctorate at Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville under A.T. Robertson, and then he goes to Yale for Ph.D. coursework, and during that time, he gets into this controversy that Doug described. Afterwards, what happens, let me back up here and talk about his SMU thing, and I'll describe it in more detail, but he comes under tremendous fire. He says some things that are not temperate for a young guy to say, probably. I didn't go back and reread all the articles. But in my view, there was just a lot of overkill, and he gets dismissed. He later becomes, after he's fired from Abilene, he becomes the chair of the department. In fact, he founds the classics department at East Texas State University in Commerce and stays there for 30 years. During that time, he goes to SMU and earns, not that he needs another degree, but he earns a master's there in church history, and he writes this massive three-volume history, 500 pages or so, of the history of churches of Christ in Texas, and unpacks a lot of what had gone on with the instrument. I somehow don't know whether Brother actually read that thesis or not in his 3 days there, but it's just a gold mine of all kinds of information. And behind the scenes, there are apologies rendered from college personnel and so forth. What basically happened is he's reacting to this article that I quoted yesterday. The world is now 5921 years old in 4004 BC. In other words, according to the Bible, according to Moses and the prophets and Christ and the apostles. And it's that kind of language that he responds to. His own view is that it is an unwarranted contention to say, if you do not think God made the world in 6 days of 24 hours each, you are an infidel. And so, again, brethren have disagreed and argued about this from a variety of standpoints through the years. To label somebody an infidel, that's the kind of thing he's responding to. And Brother Brewer sends this telegram, or writes an article, rather, Brother Sewell, if there are any ideas of theology in Abilene Christian College, get them out. No theology allowed here. Or dynamite the premises and blow the school to Gehenna. And Sewell publishes sends a telegram to the Firm Foundation office announcing W.W. Freeman will not return to Abilene Christian College. 30 years later, when he died, Yeter Tant, who himself is not widely known, I think, Yeter was one of the very few people in the 1930s among Churches of Christ to hold an MDiv, graduated from Louisville Presbyterian Seminary after Lipscomb. And here's what he wrote about him. He said, suffering cruelly and unjustly at the hands of his brethren some 30 years ago, he, Freeman, came through the ordeal with his faith in God unshaken, and what's more, with his faith in man, his brethren not embittered. We honor his memory. And so I just offer this as a kind of a case study in how sometimes our rhetoric sometimes outruns the reality. And I'm not saying that if somebody makes some outlandish comment or statement that it shouldn't be responded to. Don't misunderstand me. But I'll just leave that there. And let's unpack this topic for this morning. I think I've asked you, if not, turn to Romans chapter 12 as the first passage that I have in the outline where the apostle urges us as brethren by the mercies of God to present our bodies a living, holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which he says is your spiritual service of worship. I think this is the New American Standard translation on the screen. And do not be conformed to the world, but rather transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. And we'll get to a question that sometimes is actually an old argument that a lot of instrumental music advocates used 50 to 100 years ago. That is that all of life is worship, everything we do is worship, and therefore sort of anything goes, whatever we do is worshipful, and therefore that is acceptable. Our Lord himself, of course, warns, using, you're aware that there are several different words that are translated worship, but he said, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. This is from the English Standard Version. So, with those kind of as a framework for some principles that we'll discuss, my task this morning, as I see it, as Jim and I touch base several times and define this, I see as what I would call descriptive more than prescriptive. In other words, I'm going to try to describe some of the recent history of what has happened to get us here. I mean, I'm a historian after all, sue me, okay? But I want to situate our present-day phenomena in a kind of a context and pose some questions to explore some issues. Jim and I have discussed this several times, and this part of it has sort of morphed over the last several months to some things that were larger than what originally I envisioned anyway. And the task will be to discover what we have in common. I think we probably have a lot of things in common, but also, as I said, how do we arrive at our beliefs? And when we confront things that are perhaps matters of opinion, how do we handle that? Is it possible that we make similar errors to the Freeman idea, where we get something that we regard as a matter of faith that really isn't a matter of faith, is more a matter of opinion? And I want to do this in two areas, basically three Roman numerals in the outline. How has entertainment ideology impacted preaching? How has it impacted the worship of God in song? And then we'll look at some questions. So to set a base mark, I did a lecture a number of years ago where I went back and looked at Puritan preaching, and just very quickly, three slides to benchmark it. Puritans from the beginning of their migration to America, obviously in the first century, they were preached in plain meeting houses, of which at least 220 were built in the 1600s, and then that explodes by more than an order of magnitude over the next century. 10 times that many go up. By the American Revolution, New England has more clergy per population than anywhere else in the colonies. And these five generations of preachers preached at least 5 million sermons. You can do the math on that. A churchgoer probably listened because everybody was expected to go to church as a part of their village civic responsibilities. Probably 7,000 sermons in a normal lifespan. These sermons averaged 2 hours. If you time, there are collections of sermons, the sermons of so-and-so in libraries and repositories all over New England, and in fact the United States, although there were some. John Cotton could preach one in 30 minutes and did on several occasions. The description of sermons like this, and this is a model that lasted well into the 19th century, was an attention-getting opening, the narration of the topic, proof of an argument, and an epilogue to summarize on the first hand and to stir the audience. And this goes all the way back. These people had studied classical rhetoric from Quintilian and Cicero, Augustine, and so forth, who folded that into Christian tradition pretty early on. And key takeaways from that lecture that I want to emphasize this morning is that changes in both the substance and the style of preaching obviously change from age to age. That happens whether we like it or not. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. I put in the outline somewhere Inga's dictum that the church that marries the spirit of the age becomes a widow in the next generation. But to a certain degree, it is true. We are affected by our environment. And the main takeaway is that changes in the composition of churches is what's really driving this. This is not so much, at least in my view, from what I can tell, not so much a top-down kind of thing where the preachers are imposing a style on the churches against their will, as much as it's a grassroots sort of phenomenon where changes in the culture affect the people who sit in the pews, and they demand and vote with their feet about certain kinds of things. So broader cultural influences impact them, and so churches get the kind of preaching that they expect or demand. And if they don't demand biblical preaching, they get, I guess I would say, what they deserve. The Stone Campbell movement, as it's come to be known, I don't like that term as much as the Restoration movement, but I've lost that fight. The Stone Campbell is now the designation of record, so we'll go with it. But it originated in this era, in which orations of 2 hours or more were common. They were expected. They were even appreciated. 19th century sermons published in all kinds of anthologies appeal, first of all, to rational processes in the hearer. They assume that once a person understands the subject, that that person will align his or her will to the good news of the gospel. And that doesn't mean that emotion is absent from it. There are many emotional appeals that attempt to move people to repent or respond or engage in one way or another. The standard article in the Encyclopedia of the Stone Campbell Movement notes that many of the early Stone Campbell preachers were educated in law. Some of them had practiced law, and that extends into the 20th century, as a matter of fact, with examples that people would probably consider pretty representative and good preaching up to the midpoint of the 20th century. People like W.L. Oliphant in Dallas, Roy Cogdell, Guy Woods. These guys were all trained in law, and some of them had practiced. So their sermons were often structured as legal arguments to convince an audience in a way similar to how an attorney would attempt to convince a jury to accept their plea or their understanding. So the standard practice, again, is rooted in the idea that if one converts the mind to the gospel of salvation, that the heart, the emotion, the motivation will follow. Now, all of that changes. I'm going to back up a little bit from Sister Amy here, but that begins to change in the 19th century with these great revival movements, particularly Moody and Sankey. Yes, there were revivals, of course, before that in the so-called Great Awakening, although historians are now, some of them, challenging whether there even was such a thing. But the idea is that now we get more emotional appeals. There is less lodging. And so I've chosen Amy Semple McPherson as a sort of a model of this. She builds the Angelus Temple in Los Angeles about 1921, I think. And this is a place that has 3,500 red velvet seats with space for an orchestra and a mass choir. She standardized what she called illustrated sermons, which are actually plays, theatrical performances. Actually, this was pioneered by Evangeline Booth at the Salvation Army well before this, but Amy Semple McPherson raises this to an art form. And by that I mean, if you were to visit on a given Sunday or sometime during the week, if they're doing a special performance, you'd see props and actors all over the hallways waiting to go on stage. Worship services featured backdrops of, for example, the Garden of Eden or Sodom and Gomorrah with smoke and fire and so forth. Vesuvius erupting, Valley Forge with all the snow machines. She had costumes, special effects, stage managers. Once brought in a camel to show that, guess what? It couldn't get through the eye of a needle. Who knew? But now you have this very vivid illustration of it. Charlie Chaplin and other actors from Hollywood would sometimes, this is a production, they would sneak in to watch. Chaplin wrote a letter to us, said, half your success is due to your magnetic appeal, half due to the props and lights. And mostly what McPherson did was to narrate the story, once riding onto the stage as a motorcycle policeman to warn the audience that they were speeding to hell. I wrote an article that made this snarky comment, forgive me, but it would take avant-garde Church of Christers a mere half century to discover this new mode of preaching. But this is the kind of shift that's occurring in the 20th century, and that explicitly, candidly sometimes by their own admission, affected, as well as the impact of television preaching, people like Lynn Anderson, Max Lucado, and so forth. In contrast to this is from Hughes and Allen's, the book, The Worldly Church, where they say what I think is pretty obvious to anybody familiar with the history. There was a time when churches of Christ were widely known as people of the book. All who knew us knew that we hungered above all for the Word of God. Biblical text preaching. Yes, sometimes proof texting, not always of the highest order, but they knew that those were our highest priorities. We immersed ourselves in its truths and sacrificed dearly to share the gospel with those who had never heard. These were our most fundamental commitments. We knew it, we members of the Church of Christ, Churches of Christ, and others knew it as well. And if you track this sort of tangent of the trajectory of preaching, for example, in Richard Hughes's pretty standard history, he traces this climate of positive thinking. We've got to make our sermons more relevant. We need to appeal to audiences by adopting, first of all, the peace of mind agenda that was popular in some of the early television shows of Fulton Sheen and How to Win Friends and Influence People, that whole genre thing. Messages that extolled the true church, and these are Hughes's quotes now, and condemned the denominations for their false doctrine were not likely to develop a serious following or a significant following in the free market of radio and television evangelism and competition with the Amy Semple McPhersons of the world, at least anything beyond the ranks of the faithful. They might serve as red meat for those who are already committed to these kinds of ideas. To skin the sex is something that serves a kind of purpose in some ways. But I want to skip ahead a little bit to the mid-1980s. And there's a lot of backstory here, but this expression of concern, I had it in the book last year, but I don't think I talked about it. Appeared in 1985 or 86. It was signed by, I think originally 250, ultimately more than 300, if I recall correctly, main line. This is not an anti. This is not an NI document. This was published, produced by, and published among mainstream people. We are deeply disturbed over the liberalism evident in the Brotherhood today. By liberalism, we mean especially the following items: a drifting from Bible-centered, definitive, distinctive doctrine which once characterized our preaching. You can read this in the book last year. It's in the outline. There is a concerted effort to restructure the organization, worship, and work of the church along sectarian lines. There is a spirit of doctrinal compromise and a fellowshipping of those in blatant religious error, which has permeated our ranks. Fourth point, the world has made alarming inroads into the church. Instead of the church influencing the world for righteousness, the world has adversely affected many brethren in matters of morality and conduct of life. And I call particular attention in the outline to the fifth point, the typical emphasis of the denominational world on recreation, entertainment, and solving the social ills of society has been incorporated into the programs of many congregations, supplanting, displacing the God-given work of meeting the spiritual needs of those both within and without the body of Christ. And my next slide is, again, in a couple of minutes, a parenthesis, because I don't think it's possible for some of my I brothers and younger NI guys, I mean, this is 30-some years ago, to if you didn't live through it, to fully imagine the sort of slack-jawed amazement, I think is how I put it. Slack-jawed is a technical term, comes over from the Greek. It's one of those hyphenated terms like God, no, kidding. But I don't know how else to put it. I mean, to hear, I mean, I wrote a response or kind of a reaction to it, and what I said was no ante could have stated the case better. If you want to know in a nutshell what the NI positions were and arguments were and what they were trying to do in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, you could do no better than to look at this document. And part of the slack-jawness of it was that many of the people who signed this document, at least from the perspective of NI people, were the guys that started this movement, that sowed the seeds of the entertainment and the social gospel to whatever extent that was present. Non-institutional preachers had been saying this for years, and now to get this document signed by very well-known mainstream preachers beginning to react to the seeds of the beginnings of this progressive movement, this is actually in some ways the cause of this. Happened while I was in the run-up of the discussion to the Nashville and the Dallas meetings that I talked about last year, where we convened in a business hotel in both Nashville and Dallas, and 50 preachers from both sides for 3 days did something kind of similar to what we're doing here, although with a little more interaction, similar to last year. Last year in some ways was modeled to a certain degree on those kinds of meetings. Jim was my go-to guy for singing in Nashville. And then you get people like Abe Mallerby, now deceased, interviewed in the Christian Chronicle in February of 2002 and asked, what are some of your concerns for our fellowship? I'm just trying to document this sort of trajectory of preaching and how it is subsumed and influenced by what's going on in the entertainment oriented evangelical world. And so he says, my major concern is our cozying up to those evangelicals who put a premium on feeling and emotionalism. I don't want to step on Jody's speech next time, but evangelical priorities and language have come to suffuse much of our preaching in our fellowship. And he says that, combined with the style of preaching common in all churches these days, that is narratival and anecdotal, tell me a story, and not a biblical narrative, as somebody pointed out yesterday, but tell me my dog, or what my granddaughter did, or what I saw in the airport last week, or whatever, and results in his memorable phrase, in sermons that are as theologically thin gruel as are many of the so-called praise songs that we sing, about which more in due course. That's a classic line. I've been accused of originating the idea of the 7-Eleven hymns. you know what those are, seven words, sing them 11 times, praise choruses. And I wish I could take credit for that. I may be the guy who introduced it among non-institutional churches years ago, but I stole it from the Methodists. So, but I think Brother Mallaby was right on point here. It seems that the goal of many services is to achieve an emotional response, if not to be entertained, without imparting any biblical knowledge. And when that same non-expository approach is followed, say, in a church's Bible classes, then any restorationist nuance easily disappears. It becomes sort of plain vanilla evangelical feel-good preaching. And then you get, as we follow this trajectory, the impact of seeker churches. This is by Mark Love, who for a while was actually a preacher where my brother was an elder out in Portland, and then went to Abilene for a while as director of their lectureship, if that situates where this is coming from. Given the impressive results of seeker churches like Willow Creek, which is the big granddaddy, I'll say more about this later, in the Chicago area, the sort of the original megachurch in the evangelical universe, and then Saddleback, Rick Warren's church out in California. Given those results that are impressive in the eyes of many people, the pull to mimic their direction is nearly irresistible. And the evidence that he offers is one need only read the classified ads of churches looking for ministers in the Christian Chronicle to see the influence of seeker models on our thinking about evangelism. Find out what people want. If necessary, hire a public relations firm or research group to poll your community and find out what they want in religion, what would they come to hear, to see, to experience, and then you give it to them. Willow Creek, of course, is this huge mega church, about 20 miles north of Downers Grove, where I preach. Very impressive physical plant. Somebody was saying yesterday, you couldn't top Southeast in Louisville. Well, I've been there. You can top Southeast in Louisville. Go to Willow Creek. I mean, it is the model for that. It's the thing that has the oil change bays. Just to use one example, you go to worship service, make an appointment, you get your oil changed while you're in the worship service. Hey, generates revenue and saves time for these type A-driven personalities that go there to worship. It's just an impressive physical plant, huge auditorium with all the praise band and everything, world-class audio-visual cockpit, all kinds of cafes, coffee bars, full bookstore out in the several atriums. I mean, it is a full-service entertainment center, for lack of a better term, with a lot of other things that I'm not showing here. And some, if you followed what's gone on in the last year, the Chicago Tribune has done an extensive expose that resulted not only in Bill Hybels resigning in disgrace, but the whole board of the congregation resigned. A number of interim pastors have resigned. The most recent thing is from September 29th, $3.25 million paid in sex abuse settlements. So not only the lead pastor, but a lot of people. And it has severely affected them. Used to see, you could stand on an L station down in the loop and see all kinds of advertisements for the various campuses of Willow Creek, which I have four, five, or six satellite campuses, and those have all disappeared and so forth. So just kind of maybe an object lesson in what, as Inga said, a church that marries the spirit of the age can be a widow. Or, I mean, that's not the only one. I mean, some of you might be familiar with Ed Young's the Grapevine Texas Fellowship Church. I think maybe he's trying to outdo Amy Semple McPherson. I mean, how do you top a motorcycle on stage, drive a Ferrari, preach from a bed about sexual ethics? I suppose get some people's attention, bring out an espresso machine to tell the parable of coffee. And how do you top a Ferrari? Well, you drive a tank on stage, I guess. I think that this has affected the direction of many churches of Christ, as well as other religious bodies, is just too, as Love said, is too plain to be denied. And this is such a telling paragraph from an article whose impact and irony, I think, cannot be missed by anybody who's familiar with Restoration history. The last will and testament not of the Springfield Presbytery, but of Churches of Christ. Just when churches up and down the street are reevaluating their denominational status, they're taking their affiliation with the Southern Baptist Convention or the Assemblies of God or the Church of God in Christ off of their signs. They want to be non-denominational, even though they maintain their affiliations and make the contributions. Seeking to be more non-denominational, many among us are abandoning the goal of non-denominational Christianity and seeking to be more like other denominational churches. That we have become what we once despised is undeniable, according to this author, and I can't deny it, can't argue with it. Mike Casey's History of Preaching notes that in a lot of what he calls grace-oriented churches, rural, urban, suburban, wherever, have transformed the focus from what Alexander Campbell called the gospel fact to a user-friendly gospel. And I'll just let this sit with you for a minute. This is Casey's description. Increasingly leading preachers, he's talking about Churches of Christ now, turn to the language, props, and forms of television shows in narrating sermons. Popular television game show formats provide the form for the sermon content. Preachers become characters from popular TV sitcoms along with featured replica props, again, to narrate ideas or to create dialogue with the congregation to convey the ideas of the sermon. Jim, am I supposed to quit at 20 after?
You got about 20 minutes.
Okay, all right. And I mean, this is not me criticizing. This is Mike, who notes that he adapted the narrative capabilities of his mentor, Lynn Anderson. The impact of the Herald of Truth and of TV programs generally is another huge factor. Not just the evangelical, not just the narratival form, but the impact of the cool medium, as it is known in communication circles, the cool medium of TV. Cool meaning not impressive, but it's not a hot medium like radio. Noting that narrative or storytelling is the primary technique in Lucado's preaching, Casey reported that occasionally he has simply told a story for the entire sermon, once moving the pulpit out of the way to sit in a big chair and narrate a fable that he had written. And not only this particular individual, but Mike notes that the postmodern style of preaching is increasingly prevalent both in Church of Christ and in the evangelical world. And we heard yesterday about this Tennessee church, 4th Avenue in Franklin, where my wife's grandfather, one of the most conservative men you could pick, was an elder 60 years ago. So in two, three generations, it has moved to that. Pepperdine, I think I noted this last year. In fact, I know I put the next slide up. Appointed a woman chaplain. I have a cynical streak in me that says, how do you do that and make it palatable? Well, the same year you ask as a keynote speaker, Nadia Bowles Weber, who I was actually, somebody said she's not really a lesbian, she's bisexual, and I think I've found enough evidence to correct that. She identifies as both. The Washington Post described her liberal, foul-mouthed articulation of Christianity. That's their description, not mine, which includes a service called Beer and Hymns. Luther did it, so I guess if you're Lutheran, that's okay. That's how you make somebody else maybe look squeaky clean and maybe more palatable. I'm not sure that's the motivation. And if somebody says, and this is correct, that's another kind of an aside here, it's not in the manuscript, well, the colleges are not the church. Absolutely correct. And some of us have been saying that for years, including about Florida College or whatever college you want to talk about, and yet sometimes we act like they are. And I will make this point, that you can say that out of one side of the mouth, but then if somebody's going to make an argument that church support of colleges is absolutely essential to train preachers, or that they are, and I'm quoting here, integral agencies of the church, and therefore ought to be treated as integral agencies of the church, that's at the core of all of the housing allowances that's perhaps about to go bye-bye. You may be familiar with this lawsuit. I'm going to go on October 23rd down to the Dirksen Federal Building and hear the Seventh Circuit oral arguments on this case where the Freedom From Religion Foundation is challenging the constitutionality of preachers' housing allowances. And it's already been remanded to the lower court in Wisconsin once. It may happen again, but eventually it's going to rise almost inevitably to the level of the Supreme Court. And if it does, and if the Freedom From Religion Foundation prevails and everybody loses their housing, their tax exemption for housing allowance, then you can thank the basketball ministers at Pepperdine and Abilene, which are at the core of this suit. That's how this suit came to be, was by people trying to make colleges more than secular or even religious institutions, but advertising them and pushing them as integral agencies of the church. So that for anybody who would argue that, then it's really not possible to come back and say, well, the college is not the church. I mean, you can't have that both ways. And I know that many people in the institutional and non-institutional controversy did not advocate support of colleges. But there were many who did, from N.B. Hardiman all the way to Bachelorette Baxter, who argued in 1947 in an argument that did not prevail when Hardiman said the church, the orphanage, and the college stand or fall together, which seems to me an eminently logical argument. The same biblical arguments that can be made for one can be made for the other. That was a hard sell in 1947. I think there was probably enough anti-intellectual residue around, but by 1962, when Bachelorette Baxter makes the same argument and sends that out in a tract by the hundreds of thousands to every church that they could get an address for, that became a much more popular position. And so I'll just leave that there, and maybe we can talk about that if somebody wants to a little bit later on. But it certainly was a significant part, viewed from the non-institutional standpoint anyway, that if you claim that it is the job of the church to utilize human institutions for orphan care, for example, to make regular donations to them, then why does that same line of argumentation not follow for the training of preachers, for the education of Christians, and so forth? So that's a whole ball of wax. I want to get to the hymns here. So, but the point is, and this is sort of the shift, Max said, we don't need to be apologetic about offering entertainment. And particularly, since we can no longer afford the luxury of thinking people are going to be sitting in the pews and we'll be back every Sunday, we have to arrest their attention using every device possible, and we need not be so apologetic about entertaining them. So I have no apology, he says, for putting a good singer in front of them to entertain them, whether soloist or small group quartet or whatever. You've got to do something to reach them. And maybe a fundamental subtext of this is going back again to the change with the revivalism of the 19th century, is to what degree is, in this case, hymn worship not so much worship as a tool for evangelism? Is the point of what we do musically in the assembly not so much the praise of God or the edification horizontally of other Christians, but outreach to individuals? And surely there is some element of all of that, but the emphasis shifts somewhere along the line from when we are singing hymns of praise, we are worshiping Almighty God. And we are doing that in a reverential way that understands that this is not about entertainment. It's not about me feeling good necessarily about it, although I may be stirred by the hymn, but this is more, let's reach out to individuals and impress them with the quality of our music. Now, that occurs even in places maybe where that's not overtly intentional. I don't know if you've ever heard people talk about, man, how good did the singing sound, and we really raised the rafters. I'm talking about just good old gospel singing now. Almost as if we're going to impress not just ourselves, but maybe the visitors who come in and talk about, man, wasn't singing good, but, you know, maybe even impress the Almighty himself, who maybe we should remind ourselves, hears angels sing every day, so I doubt he's going to be very impressed by anything that we do, but that's just my opinion. So among evangelical churches, and I'm shifting now to some of the critique of hymn worship as entertainment that has roiled not only some among churches of Christ, but the whole evangelical world in the last 30, 40 years has been consumed with this argument about what some have called the worship wars. Among evangelical churches, similar trends, this is John Jefferson Davis's book on the worship of God, have caused thoughtful observers of the deafening worship band, theater-style seating arrangements, widescreen TV, this is his description now, more coffee cups than Bibles milieu, to question whether the sit back and enjoy the show, where's the popcorn, atmosphere has moved from anything truly worshipful to something much more secular than sacred. And he reports a sabbatical, obviously anecdotal, but he visited 35 Denver area churches and posed the question after hearing instance after instance after instance and observing this, when indeed does the church's attempt to be culturally relevant cross the line and become entertainment, or to coin his word, worship-edutainment? And if you look at, for example, Saddleback, which probably is now with the decline of Willow Creek, the granddaddy of the mega churches, obviously on the map hosting a presidential debate in 2008, the debate, and if you read what he says about it, he's got a whole section on worship, hymn worship in Purpose-Driven Church. The debate over what style of music should be used in worship is going to be one of the major points of conflict. In fact, it already is. And he cites James Dobson. Dobson says as the most divisive, more than pornography, more than abortion, on his radio program. And it is interesting. I'll black that for a moment. I've reflected a lot about how hymns are at once, in some ways, the most unitive and yet the most divisive of the things that we do in worship, perhaps. Unitive in the sense that, for instance, in the process of co-editing a hymnal, there's probably a nested core of 250 or 300 hymns that you will find in any Protestant hymnal, certainly regardless of denomination. I mean, we looked at every denominational hymnal we could get our hands on, and Abide With Me or Be With Me, not Be With Me, Lord, but you know what I'm talking about, just the common hymns of the faith that have been around for centuries that have served multiple generations, connected with them in their attempt to connect with the Almighty. And yet, there isn't a single, there are no two denominations that have been able to unite on a common hymnal. Everybody publishes their own hymnal, and almost inevitably what happens is that when a denomination brings out a new hymnal, that people in that denomination can't agree on it, and so what happens is they go off and use one of the third-party hymnal publishers like Hope or Word or some of the other big publishing houses that produce trans-denominational hymnals. And the only example that I know of two denominations being able to agree on a common hymnal is in 1940, the Disciples and the Northern Baptist Convention published, I think it's called a Christian hymnal, some generic title like that. They were in merger talks at that time to see if those two denominations could merge. As a matter of fact, those talks fell apart and the hymnal outlived the merger attempt. But I don't know of any other instance in which, despite the common body of hymnody that exists, that everybody sings across denominational barriers, nobody's been able to agree on a common hymnal. So anyway, you can read what Warren says, but here's what they did. This is what the Seeker model is all about. After surveying who we were reaching, we made the strategic decision to stop singing hymns, classic hymns, traditional hymns, in our Seeker services. Within a year of deciding what would be our sound, their trademark sound, Saddleback exploded with growth. I will admit that we have lost hundreds of potential members because of the style of music Saddleback uses. On the other hand, we have attracted thousands more because of the research that they did and decided that's the way that we want to go. And he makes the point that you can adjust your sound in any way with today's technology. Any church can have the same quality and sound of music. And this is actually a couple of decade old technology now, but even with that, all you need is a MIDI keyboard, some discs if you have a keyboard player, trumpet player, guitarist, but lack a drummer or a bass player, then you just plug in the tracks that you need, and with a little light show and a little smoke or mist, you can really put on an impressive show. A guy by the name of Dan Kimball explaining the appeal of the emergent church movement. This is a guy who's trained as a youth minister at both Saddleback and Little Creek. Began noticing, and he says this in his book, that more and more students who were once impressed with the music and special effects aspect of contemporary worship, the fast pace, the dramas, the media clips, the whatever else is used to attract attention, were no longer positively impacted by such things and were showing less and less interested in the worship effects. The reason being that these special effects in the video games they were used to went far beyond anything we could offer. They were outflanked and outclassed by their own sort of thing. So, Jim, how much time do I have?
Equating time. You got about 5 minutes, but we started with
less. Okay, all right. So I'll just put this out, and we can talk about this in the other hour. I believe that Scripture differentiates between what's done corporately in the ecclesia and what's done individually or privately, and we can talk about different passages. And it's been a matter of some dispute. I would say that it's at the core of many of the institutional, non-institutional issues of the past generations. And I do want to address this. This is actually from a book by Don Carson and John Piper and some other individuals. I'm not that they think any better or that it's any more credible because it comes from a source outside the restoration churches, if you will, but I'm always intrigued when somebody else in other contexts sees the same kinds of issues that I see operating among us. And so Carson says, I'm not sure it would be wise to apply the expression corporate worship to any and all activities in which groups of Christians faithfully engage. For example, all of life is worship. Going to a football match, going shopping, buying groceries, whether you're doing it for an invalid neighbor or whether you're doing it just to feed your family. Such activities doubtless fall under the do all to the glory of God rubric. That's true. And therefore properly belong to the ways in which we honor God. And therefore, they could be said to honor or to belong to worship in a broad sense. That if I'm mowing my grass or if I'm participating in a fix-up, paint-up, clean-up scheme that my homeowners association decided to do, I'm being a good neighbor, I'm doing that to the glory of God. And yet, as Carson points out, the activities in the New Testament describes when Christians gather together in the assembly, those activities are more restricted and focused. Doubtless, there can be some mutual edification, an interesting phrase, going on when a group of Christians take a sewing class together, but in the light of what the New Testament pictures Christians doing when they assemble together, there is something slightly skewed about calling a sewing class an activity of corporate worship. And it's interesting that people like Carson and Piper, and who are Keller, it is not Piper. So there is a narrower sense of worship, it appears, and this narrower sense is bound up with what he calls corporate worship, with what the assembled church does, as you can read that in the pages of the New Testament. He has some other things that I put in the outline. I'd also recommend, if you're interested in pursuing some of the critique of special music from a denominational standpoint, the book, it's a fairly short book, but Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. It's in one of the footnotes. It's a good read. We can talk about some of these passages if you like. As I read some of these texts, the activity is to sing and make melody in your heart, discussing worship addressed to God the Father, who is commanded to do this. And I would, this is a praise team kind of question, can these texts be obeyed only by a select few acting? Another question would be, are these texts limited to what we do in the assembly, or are they personal? And you can ask the same thing about a passage like Colossians 3, for instance. And I've got a whole lot of questions that I put in the two appendices that I intend to provoke interesting discussion. So, Jim, I'm going to quit for a few minutes. And all right. And then.